Today, of course, is March 23rd, and we're in our Shivim Pani Milton Scholars Curriculum in Sefer Shmot. Today, we're going to learn the ninth unit. I'm skipping the eighth unit. We had to skip one unit because we only have nine classes in this trimester. I missed one. We're going to do the ninth unit, which is called Manna from Heaven. And although it's called Manna from Heaven, I am adding to the unit from Manna to Chag HaShavuot. I'm going to try and tie it into Chag HaShavuot, which is coming up. So we have a lot to do in the next hour and a half. Let's begin by reading the verses, and we can read them either in the textbook or in the Chumash. In the Chumash, we're talking about Sefer Shmot, the book of Exodus, chapter 16, verses 1 to 36. Verses 1 to 36. I'll just give you a few seconds to find that. Again, you can look in the workbook or in the Chumash itself. It's chapter 16, verses 1 to 36. In the workbook, it's going to be about page, what, 180?
217.
Okay.
Section 9, Manna from Heaven.
So here we go in our reading. First, we have to know, of course, where we are. So chapter 16 comes after chapters 12, 13, 14, and 15. Chapter 12, that's when the Israelites left Egypt. Then chapter 13 and 14 brought us to the splitting of the Red Sea. And we just got past chapter 15, which was the song that the Israelites sang upon coming up to dry land on the other side of the sea. So when we read now chapter 16, we're really on a direct journey from the land of Egypt through the Red Sea on our way, of course, to Mount Sinai. And it says at the beginning of this chapter, setting out from Elam, the whole Israelite community came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elam and Sinai, right, on their way to Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. So the first thing we want to notice is how much time has passed, actually, since they've left Egypt. How many days?
45 days.
Not 45. What day did they leave Egypt?
75 days.
Not 75? What day did they leave Egypt? This is the second month since they left.
Right. Before Passover.
They left after Passover. Then the Passover meal began the 14th of the first month at twilight, before the sun went down. When the sun went down, they began eating, and that became the 15th of the month. In the middle of the night, the plague of the firstborn, Paro says, leave my country immediately. And at midnight, they start leaving. It's the 15th of the month, and they're walking most of the late night until the sun goes up the next morning. They're still walking. It's the 15th of the month. That's the first month. Now we're the 15th of the second month. So how many days have passed?
30.
About 30. The truth is about 29. Because we're talking about lunar months, and lunar months have 28 or 29 days. Mm. So it's about 28 or 29 days have passed, but only that. Only that. They were slaves just a month ago. We'll read on. In the wilderness, the whole Israelite community grumbled against Moshe and Aaron. And instead of reading on, let's just again get our bearings. They're grumbling against their leaders. They are upset. They are aggravated. Things aren't going as they expected. And let's remember, is this new behavior or have they grumbled against their leaders in the past? So they have grumbled against their leaders in the past. It's not anything new. Since we didn't see the verses about their grumbling, I thought it might be a good idea just to see that right now to again get our bearings on how the nation relates to its newfound freedom and how it relates to its leaders. So if we keep a finger where we are on chapter 16 and we go back to the previous chapters, well, when was the first time they started grumbling? They started grumbling at the sea when they came face to face with the water and wondered, what are we going to do? The Egyptians are chasing us from behind and we have nowhere to go. So that grumbling you can find in the chapter 15, and actually, if I remember, it's look at this, chapter 14, verses 10 and henceforth. See the place, chapters 14:10 and henceforth. So it says, as Paro drew near, the whole army of Egypt is chasing them. The Israelites caught sight of the Egyptians advancing upon them, greatly frightened. The Israelites cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moshe, "Was it for want of graves in Egypt that you brought us to die in the wilderness?" Right? It was no good dying there. We had to die here. What have you done to us? Take us out of Egypt. Is this not the very thing we told you in Egypt, saying, "Let us be. We will serve the Egyptians. It's better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." So they're already complaining. They're afraid, right? And that's not the first time it happened.
Nothing's changed in 3,500 years.
People remain people.
Well, but this is a whole different thing. I mean, this is in the wilderness for 28, 29 days. Did you ever take a 28-day trip in the wilderness? Wouldn't you be grumbling?
I've been in Dallas for 7 years.
They don't know where they're going even.
You're right. Right. I'm not saying it's not justified. I just want us to remember what has been the antecedents to the grumbling we see in this week's study. Let's now look at chapter 15. At the end of chapter 15, I believe it is, in verse 22. Chapter 15, verse 22. Exodus 15:22. Then Moses caused Israel to set out from the Sea of Reeds. After their sea was split, they went through it. They went on the wilderness of Shur. They traveled 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. They came to Marah, but they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. That is why it was called Marah, which means bitter. And the people grumbled against Moshe, saying, "What shall we drink?" So you see, a second time, the people's first reaction when they come to adversity and hardship is to complain. So it happens that what we're learning today in chapter 16, that they're complaining to Moshe, it's not the first time, it's not the second time, it's the third time. And indeed, it won't be the last time. Okay, so now we can read on in chapter 16, verse 3. The Israelites said to them, to Moses and Aaron, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, when we ate our fill of bread. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to starve this whole congregation to death." Those are pretty strong words that the people are speaking against their leaders who took them from slavery to freedom.
I mean, do you think that they're just looking back and thinking that it was so wonderful because, I mean, like they eat bread, and we have talked before that they probably ate matzah, not bread. Maybe they're just sort of like the grass looks greener on the other side.
Yeah, right. Exactly what I was going to ask. Carol Ann just asked. Oh. Very good. Right? It's hard to believe that their memories of slavery are very accurate. Perhaps they're just hallucinating. Were there flesh pots? Did they sit around and have barbecues every night when they were slaves? Hard to believe. And they ate their fill of bread. Well, like Carol Ann said, we learned that they probably ate matzah. Now they suddenly remember all this bread. And it could be they saw a lot of bread in the pastry shops of the Egyptians, but did they actually get to eat it? Not so clear that they did. Not so clear. Now, that's one thing that certainly bothers us, these rose-colored glasses that they're looking back at slavery with. Another thing that might bother us is that they say, "For you have brought us out into this wilderness." What do you mean, you? What about God? But of course, the people never saw God. Certainly never saw God. They never talked to God. All they know is Moses and Aaron. So when the going goes good, so the people believe that Moses and Aaron have some God behind them. When the going gets bad, all the arrows and all the criticism, of course, going to fall upon what the people can see, their leaders, Moses and Aaron.
But they saw the miracles that God did and the plagues that he did.
You're right. They saw the miracles, but right, we think of God as a something. We live in a culture that has this word God and believes in God. We don't exactly know what it is, but it's a something. It exists. But for them, all they know is what Moses and Aaron told them. They don't have a history, at least not a strong history. They might have a weak tradition from Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov that they were told there's one God, but it certainly wasn't passed down very strongly during the years of slavery. And Moses and Aaron do all these miracles, and they say that there's a God behind it, splitting the Red Sea, but what do the people know? They know Moses and Aaron. So anyway, the people are complaining against these leaders that have brought them out of the flesh pots of Egypt to death in the desert.
They had already lost faith once. Now they're just saying, huh, you know, we were right. You know?
Right, yeah, it's not the first time. It's not the first time. Actually, I forgot to mention that not only did they grumble when they got to Marah and there was no water to drink, or it was bitter, not only did they grumble when the Egyptians were chasing them at the Red Sea, but they also grumbled, remember, the first time Moses and Aaron went before the plagues, went to Paro and said, let my people go, and as a result of that, Paro increased the workload. And then the people said, what are you getting involved for? You know, forget about it, we'll stay as slaves. In a certain sense, it's comfortable to be a slave, because that's the way it is, and you have no responsibility, you just do what you're told, and now they're in the desert. Well, in Egypt, at least we had something to eat. Here, who knows? No water, no food, what's going to happen? It's hard to be free. So we're going to go on and read. And the Lord said to Moshe, I will rain down bread for you from the sky, and the people shall go out and gather each day that day's portion, that I may thus test them to see whether they follow my instructions or not. But on the sixth day, when they apportion what they have brought in, it shall prove to be double the amount they gather each day. Let's just think about what we just read. So this is, of course, what's called later manna. God's going to rain down bread, and they're going to go out and gather each day that day's portion, that I may test them. So this is a test. Now we know the concept of test from other places in the Torah. For example, Avraham was tested at the Akedah when he was told by God to bind and to kill his son. That was a test. Now when we talk about a test, there's a fundamental question that arises, because God has to test and see how they are going to respond. God doesn't know what Avram's going to do. God doesn't know what the people are going to do. So probably when we talk about a test in the biblical sense of God testing, it's not that God wants to see the results. He wants to. He doesn't know what's going to happen, and he wants to be shown what the results could be. Rather, God wants a certain result. Let me give an example. I always give the same example, and it's so mundane. The seventh grade basketball team is going on to the court for the first time after they've been practicing for 2 weeks. And in his pep talk before the game, the coach says to the boys, I want to see how you're going to do. Does he all want to see what they're going to do? No. He wants them to win. He doesn't want to see. It's not that he has a question. I want to see what you can do. He wants to get a certain result. And he's giving them the opportunity to prove themselves. And it's not like a multiple choice test, what's going to be the result. It's rather to steal them. It's to make them better. It's that they've learned the game. They know how to play. They can win. Now let's see you win. In other words, now let's have you put into practice what you have learned. Let's see you bring your potentiality to actuality. Let's steal you. Let's bring all your talents and all your abilities. Let's make them real. That's what happened in the Akedah. It's not that God doesn't know how Avram's going to do. He's being tested, not in the sense that God doesn't know if he's going to do what he's told not going to do. God knows what he's going to do, but he has to be given the opportunity to do what he can do. Because only when you do what you can do you become that. You could be born with all the talent in the world, with all the faith in the world, with all the courage in the world, with all the business ability in the world. If you don't use that ability, if you don't put it into practice, it doesn't become part of you. It doesn't flower. It doesn't mold your personality. It doesn't bring you to the highest, the next level. The people have to be tested, not because God doesn't know what they're going to do, but because they have to be given the opportunity to stand tall in this test. And that is going to make them into something better. But still the question is, what's the test? What's the test? So I'll read it again. I will rain down, I'm reading verse 4, rain down bread for you from the sky, and the people shall go out and gather each day that day's portion, that I may test them to see whether they will follow my instructions or not. So it's not clear what exactly the test is. So I now read some verses further on together with you to try and figure out what this text actually is, what the test is. So if we go forward to verses that come later in the story, I am looking now at verse 16. Let's do verse 14. When the fall of dew lifted, there over the surface of the wilderness lay a fine and flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather as much of it as each of you requires to eat. An omer, that's a measure, to a person for as many of you as there are. Each of you shall fetch for those in his tent." The Israelites did so, some gathering much, some little. But when they measured it by the omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who gathered little had no deficiency. They had gathered as much as they needed to eat. So if I had five people in my tent, then it came out, even if I gathered for 5 hours, there was only five omer. And another neighbor of mine who had four souls in his tent, he gathered for 5 minutes, but it miraculously grew and became four omer, one omer for each person. And Moses said to them, "Let no one leave any over until the morning." But they paid no attention to Moses. Some of them left of it until morning, and it became infested with maggots and stank. And Moses was angry with them. So they get every morning, each as much as he needed to eat, for when the sun grew hot, it would melt. It disappeared. So that's the story, or part of the story of the man. So what's the test? Myron, then.
Or that they would gather what they needed instead of doing more.
Okay, and what does that test? What qualities?
That you're dependent on God, that you need God in your life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Carol-Ann?
That you're not be so selfish, that you want to gather and hoard
mm-hmm.
more of it.
You can't hoard it, right?
As much as you can eat. Right.
And if you gather a little,
too much,
you have as much as you need. If you gather too much, it disappears. You can't save it for tomorrow. Which means, just think of this. When you go to sleep at night, you know that when you wake up in the morning, the refrigerator is empty. The previous day, you only had enough for that day. And if you tried to hoard and keep it for tomorrow, it said that it goes bad, right? It doesn't last. You can't keep it in the refrigerator or the cupboard. You wake up in the morning and you know the cupboards are bare, and you have to depend on the fact that more is going to appear in the field that morning.
So it's a test of faith.
It's a test of faith.
And self-discipline.
And self-discipline of relying on God. And I can just imagine, like myself, under such circumstances, I can't imagine a more difficult, excruciating, torturous test. Think of a parent who has five little kids at home. You go to sleep in the nighttime, you have no idea what you're going to feed them the next day. And I say no idea, I mean, if God doesn't provide, then they're going to starve. There'll be nothing to eat. And it's teaching something that, from a modern perspective, is actually a very, very negative character trait. It's teaching the opposite of self-reliance. The opposite of self-reliance. It's teaching you can't rely on yourself. That as much work as you do, you'll never have enough for tomorrow. As much as you gather, it miraculously shrinks to what you need for that day, leaving nothing over for tomorrow. Right? Today, in the 21st century, we teach our children and our grandchildren, we teach them self-reliance, get a good job, provide for yourself, provide for your family, save money in the bank, take a good insurance policy for fire and water damage and theft and hurricane. And this parsha is teaching them just the opposite. This is frightening. This is literally a frightening message for us to deal with. It's teaching them no insurance, right? No self-reliance, no good job, no money in the bank, nothing in the refrigerator, no credit. You go to sleep and you have nothing in the house. I can certainly understand why it's called a test. I can certainly understand why it's called a test. But of course, the question is, okay, is that what God wants us to learn? Is that what God wants to inculcate within our spirits? To rely on Him and do nothing else? That seems to be the message for 40 years in the desert. That's hard. So I'm going to leave this question, this issue, on the table for the next 15 minutes until we read the rest of the verses of the parsha. But this really has to be centrally debated and discussed by us, and we have to struggle what's going on here. Is that the message of Judaism? So you have to be bothered, right? Bothered by this. This is really hard. Okay, so we're going to go on and we're going to come back to this. We'll spend a good part of the morning on this question. So let's go back and finish out the whole section. We were reading back at the beginning of 16. We read verse 4. Let's read verse 4 and go on. And the Lord said to Moshe, verse 4, I will rain down bread for you from the sky, and the people shall go out and gather each day that day's portion, that I may thus test them, to see whether they will follow my instructions or not. And again, I said, it doesn't mean that God has to see. God knows, but He has to give them the opportunity to follow the instruction for what it's going to teach them and do to their personalities. But on the sixth day, when they apportion what they have brought in, it shall prove to be double the amount they gather each day. It's going to expand. Instead of contract, it's going to expand on Friday. So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, by evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out from the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall behold the presence of the Lord, because he has heard your grumblings against the Lord. For who are we that you should grumble against us? So just pointing out here, this appearance of the manna is not only to give them food, but it's also to teach them, to remind them that this isn't the show, Moses and Aaron show. This is the God show. Because there's really two issues here. One issue is food to eat. The other issue is faith in God. Just like we talked about many classes earlier, that at the time of the plagues, why did God bring the plagues? Not only to take them out of Egypt, but in order to teach them a theological lesson that God is in charge. If God's only purpose was to take them out of Egypt, He could have just blinded the Egyptians and walked the Israelites out. Rather, God made the whole big show of the 10 plagues to teach a lesson. And that's continuing here. God could have brought them food in a natural fashion, but He specifically brings them food in a miraculous fashion, apparently, because the purpose is not only to give them food, the purpose is to make a show, to teach them something, that it's not Moses and Aaron who've been leading you out. There's a force behind everything else.
I guess that extra manna that they collected on sixth day didn't have maggots in it by the next morning.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. The Shabbat manna is different than the manna of the 6 days of the week. And that's going to actually develop in the text as we read it. Verse 8, since it is the Lord, Moses continued, who will give you flesh to eat in the evening and bread in the morning to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumblings you utter against Him. You're not complaining against Moses and Aaron. There's a Him behind this. What is our part? Say, Moses and Aaron, it's not us. Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, say to the whole Israel community, advance towards the Lord, for He has heard your grumbling. And as Aaron spoke to the whole Israelite community, they turned toward the wilderness, and there in a cloud appeared the presence of the Lord. I want to stop for a minute and just think, what does that mean, the presence of the Lord? So I want to do two things. I want to look back at two different sets of verses, to try and figure out what that means here, that a cloud appeared the presence of the Lord. So first of all, I'll ask a question. Thinking of what you know about the Torah, things we've read this year, things we haven't read this year, how does God appear? In what material, in what form does God appear?
Burning bush.
Burning bush.
Bush.
Good, right? Burning bush. And at Sinai, remember? We didn't read that yet. At Sinai, how does God appear?
Smoke and fire.
Smoke and fire. Okay. So that's point number one, that God appears as fire. Now, let's hold our fingers where we are, and I want to go back and think about this cloud that we just read about. So we're going to go back to the story of the crossing of the Red Sea, which is in chapter 14, where it says, chapter 14, verse 19. Chapter 14, verse 19. The angel of God, who had been going ahead of the Israelite army, now moved and followed behind them, and the pillar of cloud shifted from in front of them and took a place behind them. So there was a pillar of cloud that, according to the story, accompanied them out of Egypt and led them. And now it's shifting from in front of them to behind them to act as a shield between them and the approaching Egyptian army. And now I want to see that this cloud is mentioned at other points. Let me see if I can find where the cloud is mentioned. Not here. Let me look. Right, I found it. Back at the end of chapter 13. Chapter 13, verse 21. The Lord went before them in a pillar of cloud by day to guide them along the way, and the pillar of fire by night to give them light, that they may travel day and night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. Okay, so that's all our information. So the information is as follows. At the burning bush and at Sinai, God appears as fire. When they left Egypt, God appeared as a cloud in front of them during the daytime and as a pillar of fire at night. With all that information in our back pockets, we go to the verse we were just reading in chapter 16 a few minutes ago. Back to chapter 16, verse 10. Back to 16, verse 10, where we were. And as Aaron spoke to the whole Israelite community, they turned towards the wilderness, and there in a cloud appeared the presence of the Lord. So what could it mean that in the daytime, in a cloud appeared the presence of the Lord? With the information we have, anyone now have a... Can you draw it for us? What might this look like? How does the presence of the Lord appear in a cloud? Ah, that's what some of the commentators say. They saw a fire in the cloud. A fire in the cloud.
Makes sense.
Right.
You don't see that every day.
You don't see that every day, and not every other day either, right? So it could be that that's what the verses mean, that they saw the cloud that they usually saw, but now there was a fire inside the cloud, and that is representative in some sense of God's presence. Good. Okay. Let's read on. Verse 11. The Lord spoke to Moshe. I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Speak to them and say, by evening you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall have your fill of bread, and you shall know that I, the Lord, am your God. So again, there are two major goals here. One is to give them food, and the other is that they should know that I am the Lord. And of course, the third goal, as we read earlier, is this test that we talked about earlier, this test of faith, which we'll get back to. In the evening, quail appeared and covered the camp. So in a miraculous fashion, you have these flocks of quail that just land in the camp, and there's so many of them you can just pick them up and put them on the barbecue. That's the meat. And that's the evening. In the morning, there was a full of dew about the camp. We read these verses earlier. When the full of dew lifted, there over the surface of the wilderness lay a fine and flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said one to the other, Manhu. That's what the Hebrew says, Manhu. For they did not know what it was. And the implication seems to be that the phrase Manhu means what is it? By the way, that's not Hebrew. In Hebrew you would say Mahu. But the verse says that they said Manhu. Some say they were talking Egyptian. And why do we call it Mana? Because they said Manhu. Man meaning what? So the translation of Mana is what not? That's what it is. What not? Whatever it is. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather as much of it as each of you requires to eat. An omer to a person for as many of you as there are. Each of you shall fetch for those in his tent. The Israelites did so, some gathering much, some little. But when they measured it by the omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no deficiency. It shrunk or it expanded according to the need. They had gathered as much as they needed to eat. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it until morning. And of course, any good father or mother would want to leave till the morning because you have to provide for your family for the next day. But you're not allowed. But they paid no attention to Moses. Some of them left it until morning, and it became infested with maggots and stank. And Moses was angry with them. So they gathered every morning, each as much as he needed to eat. For when the sun grew hot, it would melt. On the sixth day, they gathered double the amount of food, two omers for each. It's not that each person did more work of collecting. They gathered the normal amount, but expanded on Fridays. And when all the chieftains of the community came and told Moshe, he said to them, why do they run? Why do you think the chieftains ran to Moshe when the food expanded and one omer became two? What do you think they're afraid of? Okay, they're afraid of maggots. Could they be afraid of also criticism? Mm-hmm. For what? Criticism for gathering too much. Because they hope that they've learned a lesson, only gather an omer for a person. Suddenly, on the first Friday, it's double. Whoa, Moses is going to accuse us of gathering too much. So they run to Moses. Look what happened. And he said to them in verse 23, this is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow's a day of rest, a holy Sabbath of the Lord. Bake what you would bake, and boil what you would boil, and all that is left put aside to be kept until morning. Now, what that means is not that you bake what you need for Friday and boil what you need for Friday and leave the raw stuff for tomorrow. It means bake what you need for the 2 days and eat what you eat on Friday and leave the rest of it over. That's already cooked for the morning. So they put it aside until morning, as Moses had ordered, and it did not turn foul, and there were no maggots in it. Then Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath of the Lord. You will not find it today on the plain. 6 days you shall gather it. On the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be no food. There will be none. Yet some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found nothing. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you men refuse to obey my commandments and my teachings? Mark that the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you 2 days' food on the sixth day. Let everyone remain where he is, let no man leave his place on the seventh day. So the people remained inactive on the seventh day. I see that there is actually a very beautiful pedagogical point in the verses that we just read about the manna on Friday that was enough for Shabbat. There's something that seems strange. First, the manna is in the field Friday morning, and miraculously, whatever people gather, it doubles. They come to Moses and ask, what is this? What happened? He tells them that it's for tomorrow. And when it lasts for tomorrow, then he tells them, this is the Sabbath. The instruction, the explanation, comes after the deeds. Very fascinating. You might expect to be the opposite. Moses should have said, tomorrow's Shabbat, look what's going to happen, and it happens, and then they experience it. But it's the opposite. They experience it, and then Moses explains it. To me, that's a really, really important pedagogical point. And it's a point you find throughout the Torah, that the real way to understand something is not to learn it from a book. It's to first experience it. And then the explanations fall into place. When you have a experience that you can afterwards explain, it makes much more sense from an educational point of view to first experience and then explain than to explain in the classroom and then try and later experience it. And that's something that I actually learned from my teachers over 35 years ago. It's a principle that is expressed in Jewish philosophy in a book called Sefer HaChinuch, the Book of Education, written in about the 13th century in Spain. And the phrase goes like this. I'll say it in Hebrew and then I'll say it in English. Acharei hapulot nimshachot halevavot. Just four words. Acharei hapulot, after the actions, nimshachot halevavot, are pulled the hearts. The hearts, in other words, the more intellectual or emotional, whatever it is, the inner part of us follows the outer part. Acharei hapulot nimshachot halevavot, the heart follows the actions. First, you do something with your limbs, you experience it, you live it, you act it out, and then you can begin to understand it. Then your heart can absorb it and make sense of it. But don't go the opposite order. Don't try and understand it until you actually have lived it and experienced it. And the truth is that this principle, that action has to be the main element of learning, that you do it and then you understand it, that actually is a principle that is at the center of the holiday we're about to celebrate, Shavuot. Because the big principle that everyone talks about at the getting of the Torah at Mount Sinai is that the people said, Naseh v'nishma, we will do and we'll understand, in that order. First you do it, and then through the doing you get to understand it. But you can't just understand it through a book, intellectually, hearing a lecture. You have to naseh v'nishma, do, and then comes the intellectual activity that makes sense of the action, of the lifestyle, of the behavior, of what you went through. An important educational principle that should be put into practice more, I think. So anyway, back to finishing up our reading here. We're in verse 31. The house of Israel named it manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and it tasted like wafers and honey. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let one omer of it be kept throughout the ages, in order that they may see the bread that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out from the land of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, take a jar, put one omer of manna in it, and place it before the Lord, to be kept throughout the ages. As the Lord has commanded Moses, Aaron placed it before the pack, that is the ark, to be kept. And the Israelites ate manna 40 years, until they came to a settled land. They ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. Omer is a tenth of an ephah. Wouldn't it be great if we had that jar today?
Yeah, I was thinking that. I wonder what happened to it.
Yeah, it's part of the whole story of the Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know what happened to the ark that Moses made that was accompanied the Israelites into land of Israel with Yeshua, Joshua, and through the time of the judges and then the prophets. It was taken into captive in Babylonia, conquered by Persia. What happened to it? But of course, that's a whole can of kosher manna. Another can of kosher worms. So, there are lots of different subjects here. One of the main subjects is the one that we began discussing 15 minutes ago, which is the test to teach faith and reliance on God. But we asked ourselves, what type of message is that? That you shouldn't do anything for your own, you should be passive, wait for God to bring the manna, don't provide for your children, don't buy insurance, don't look out for them, don't have a bank account. That's what it seems to teach. But what could be going on here? Is that the message of the Torah? So I want to focus on that really for a long time now. And of all the sources that they gave us in our workbook, I chose to see, out of the 13 of them, only one. And it's the one that talks about this particular issue. So this is on page 237. It's source number 11. Page 237. From the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Yomah, page 76a. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was asked by his disciples, why did not the man come down unto Israel once annually? Once a year, let it fall, and they can hoard it and save it up. He replied, I shall give a parable. This thing may be compared to a king of flesh and blood who had one son, for whom he provided sustenance once a year. Once a year he gave the king gave his son a credit card with all the money he needed for the year. And so his son would visit his father only once a year to get the money. Thereupon, in other words, afterwards, the king learned his lesson. He provided for his sustenance every day, so that he called on him every day. If the parent wants to see his child every day, he better not give them all the money for the year at the beginning of the year. Provide it every day, then the kids will come running. The same with Israel. One who had four or five children would worry, saying, perhaps no man will come down tomorrow and all will die of hunger. Thus they were found to turn their attention to their Father in heaven. So this parable doesn't answer our question, it actually exacerbates our question. Because the parable says, yeah, the purpose is to make them dependent on God, to make them realize their dependence on God, to be dependent on God every single day.
But they probably needed it because they didn't have that faith, so they needed to have that reinforced to them every day.
They did. But it still, at least for me, brings us to the question, is that the type of faith that the Torah really wants to instill? I mean, according to that, it would seem that we should just abandon our jobs and abandon our bank accounts and abandon our homes and abandon our credit scores and abandon insurance and just wait for God to provide.
And go to the synagogue every day, right?
Yeah, that's what it seems to be teaching, and it doesn't seem to be exactly in accord with what we know about Judaism. And to begin answering the question, we have to go to the book of Deuteronomy. So you have to go back to the Chumash, to Deuteronomy, to chapter 8. Chapter 8 of the book of Deuteronomy. Here's the key.
Chapter 8 where?
Chapter 8 from verse 2. So as we remember, Deuteronomy is the end of the five books of Moses. It's Moses' last speeches to the Israelites after 40 years in the desert, before he's about to die. And he's summing up their 40 years in the desert. He's summing up all the experiences he's gone through with the people. Verse 2. Remember the long way that the Lord your God has made you travel in the wilderness these past 40 years. That he might test you by hardship to learn what was in your hearts, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He subjected you to the hardship of hunger, and I'm going to disagree with the translation. The JPS, the next word is then. I suggest to take that word then out. It's not in the Hebrew. Verse 3, I would read it without that word as follows. He subjected you to the hardship of hunger and gave you manna to eat, which neither you nor your fathers had ever known, in order to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but that men may live on anything that the Lord decrees. A better translation of the end of verse 3, but that men may live on anything that comes forth from the mouth of God. That's what it literally says. That men may live on anything that comes forth from the mouth of God. The clothes upon you did not wear out, nor did your feet swell these 40 years. End. So, what we just read is actually a summary of the points we've seen already in chapter 16 of Exodus. And we read it again now and explain how it dovetails with what we saw in Exodus for the past 50 minutes. Verse 2 again. Remember the long way the Lord your God has made you travel in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might test you. Right? We learned about the test. It said in Exodus 16 that the manna is a test. Test you by hardship to learn what was in your hearts. My suggestion is the hardship is not a physical hardship, it's a spiritual hardship. It's an emotional, it's the hardship of going to sleep and not knowing what you're going to feed your kids tomorrow. It's the hardship of not being able to rely on yourself, not being able to support your family through the labor of your own two hands. The manna didn't leave them hungry in their stomachs, but it left them hungry in their hearts. Because every good father and mother wants to be able to provide security. That's the word security for their families. And the test was, the hardship was, you have to live for 40 years with no way to provide security for yourself and your spouse and your children and your community. No security except relying on God. That's what it means, that he might test you by hardship to learn what was in your hearts. And learn what's in your hearts doesn't mean that God doesn't know what's in your heart. It means God wants to put something into your heart. He wants to put into your heart that sense of non-self-reliance. Rather, reliance on God. No human security, only divine security. Whether you would keep his commandments or not, God wants to inculcate into you the reliance on him, on his word. He subjected you to the hardship of hunger and gave you manna to eat. The reason I took the word then out of the text is because it's not hunger and then manna. The manna is the hunger. The manna makes you hungry. It doesn't make you hungry physically. It makes you hungry emotionally. It leaves you dissatisfied. And just imagine, right? Someone says to you, I'm going to give you $1 million, but not in your bank account. Come to me every morning and I'll give you $1,000. That's great, but it's terrible.
Because you're so dependent.
Because you're so dependent. And every human being wants to be self-reliant. Mm-hmm. This was really a hardship. The manna filled your stomachs, but it filled your heart with fear. That's the test. So he subjected you to the hardship of hunger and gave you manna to eat. The manna is the hardship of hunger. Spiritual hunger. Emotional hunger. Which neither you nor your fathers had ever known, in order to teach you that man lives by what comes forth from God, to teach you reliance on God. And then it says, the clothes upon you did not wear out, right? Nor did your feet swell these 40 years. Notice, you didn't have to make new clothes. It was all just God gave you your clothes. So that is not an answer to our question. Is that what the Torah wants, such self-reliance on God? That just states the facts, that that's what the experience in the desert was about. But now, I suggest that we'll find in the book of Deuteronomy here a solution to our question. The question, is that really what God wants? Let's see. Verse 5. Bear in mind that the Lord your God disciplines you. Discipline in the sense of educates you, trains you. Bear in mind that the Lord your God trains you just as a man trains his son. Therefore keep the commandments of the Lord your God, walk in his ways and revere him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land with streams and springs and fountains issuing from plain and hill, a land of wheat and barley, of vines, figs and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land where you may eat food without stint, where you will lack nothing, a land whose rocks are iron and from whose hills you can mine copper. When you've eaten your fill, give thanks to the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Take care, lest you forget the Lord your God and fail to keep his commandments, his rules, and his laws which I enjoin upon you today. When you have eaten your fill and have built fine houses to live in, and your herds and your flocks have multiplied, and your silver and gold have increased, and everything you own has prospered, beware lest your heart grow haughty and you forget the Lord your God. I'm skipping to verse 17. And you say to yourself, my own power and the might of my own hand has won this wealth for me. Remember that it's the Lord your God who gives you the power to get wealth in fulfillment of the covenant that he made on oath with your fathers, as is still the case. I'm going to explain. So in the desert, for 40 years, manna from heaven, rely on God, no security, you can't provide for your family, it's just God. And then it says, I'm bringing you into the land of Israel. And the land of Israel is a place of good fields and of barley and wheat and vines and figs and pomegranates. It's a place where you can go to the rocks and get iron out of them. From the hills you can mine copper. And you can make for yourself a good life. That's what the verse, I'm just summarizing. And then it said, take care lest you forget the Lord your God. And say, this is all my initiative. I've gotten all this power and this wealth for myself. No, remember that it's God that gives you the power to get wealth. I just summarize. So listen now to what's going on here. The period of 40 years in the desert was everything comes from God. Then they go into the land of Israel and it no longer comes from God. There's no longer any manna. In the land of Israel, there's the option to mine from the earth. You have to do it. There's fields that can support barley and wheat, but you have to plow and plant and protect and harvest and make bread. There are trees, but you have to trim the trees. You have to harvest the fruit. You have to prepare it. So the land of Israel, as opposed to the desert, it's a place where you have to make the efforts. You have to rely upon yourself. If you don't do it, no one's going to do it for you. And you'll starve. If you don't, do what has to be done. If you do what has to be done, you have a good chance of providing for yourself and your family and your community. However, the verses say there's a danger in the self-reliance of the land of Israel. You're liable to say to yourself, ah, it's all me. Look what I've accomplished. And you'll forget that there's God behind the scenes. He's given all the possibilities. He created the world. He is in control of the laws of nature. So in a scenario of self-reliance, like the land of Israel, there's a danger. And what you have to do is remember the 40 years in the desert. When you're in the land of Israel and you're doing what has to be done, and you're making the efforts, and it depends on you, there's the danger of haughtiness. It's only me. The solution is, remember the years of the desert when you saw directly that everything comes from God. Remember now in the land of Israel, when you're doing the work, that behind the scenes you're depending on God's raw materials. So my point is as follows. The period of 40 years in the desert of complete reliance on God, that's not the way it's supposed to be. That's not the end ideal. It's rather a period of time that's meant to inculcate within you the truth of God's power to sustain, so that when you get into the land, you live real life as you're supposed to. You don't let it go to your head, but you remember that God is always there in the background. The purpose of the period in the desert was not to live like that forever. It was rather to have in your consciousness that God has those abilities and God pulls the strings, so that when you're in the land for the next million years doing what has to be done with insurance and with bank accounts and with investment and with effort and with working 12-hour days and with all the planning and the effort and the self-reliance, that when you live like that as you're supposed to, you remember that God is the one that gives you the strength to do all of this. So, to me, that's the solution to our problem. That the experience of the manna in the desert is not an ideal of reliance on God. and you do nothing. No, that's not the ideal. That's a certain time in your development so that when you get older and enter the land of Israel, you'll remember that you are really a partner with God in everything that you're doing. It shouldn't go to your head and you shouldn't say, it's me and my own power has gotten me all this wealth. And I want to kind of close this part of our class out by going back to verse 5.
What page are you on?
Verse 5 in
287 in the JPS English only. It's chapter 8 of Deuteronomy. We're just going to summarize what we said by looking at verse 5. Chapter 8 of Deuteronomy, that was the whole chapter of the chapter we've just talked about. Chapter 8, verse 5. Bear in mind that the Lord your God disciplines you, trains you, just as a man trains his son. The reason for me that verse is so important here, because one trains his son in different fashions at different ages. A parent, a mother or a father, first, when the child is born, age 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you train them to rely completely on the parent. That you're going to provide all their needs. They should have a feeling that they can rely on you. They don't have to do anything. You want to give them that sense of security. That's when they're an infant. And that's the way God behaved with the Jewish people in the desert. Rely on me. You don't have to do anything. But that's not the end game. That's not the goal. The idea is that the child has to grow up. So God behaves towards the Jewish people as a parent behaves toward a child. First, you teach the child, rely on me. I'll do everything. You can feel secure in faith in the parent or faith in God. But you have to also grow up. And eventually, the parent teaches the child not to rely only on me, but you have to also now do things on your own. And you have to let the child go free and independence and growth and maturity. But the child wants, of course, we want him to know or him to know that as much as they rely on themselves as they get older, and they should, but they can always remember that their parent was there for them, and that gives them a sense of security as they grow older. And that's what we've talked about for the past half an hour. The period of the man in the desert is an essential period in the development of the Jewish people, but it's not the end goal. Reliance on God is not the end goal. The end goal is to grow up and rely on yourself. But remember that God has given you all this. Just like the child grows up and has to become self-reliant, but he remembers what he got from his parents.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, right. And actually what Moses says here is hopefully, right? Hopefully we'll think back to our childhood when we're in the desert with God and remember that God is there with us, but only as a partner and not as him doing everything with us sitting back and twiddling our thumbs. That's only for infants. So, that's good. But I purposely left us 20 minutes or 25 minutes because I want to tie all this into Chag HaShavuot, the holiday of Shavuot that's coming this Saturday night. A good deal of what I'm about to say Carol Ann heard on Monday night, but she didn't hear how it connects to the manna. Right. She just heard about Chag HaShavuot in of itself. So I'm going to summarize some things I said on Monday and then connect them to the manna and to the desert and to everything we talked about now going into the land of Israel. Okay. I'm just letting my cell phone stop buzzing. It stopped. The holiday of Shavuot is dealt with in many passages in the Torah. And by the way, everything we have to say is on the sheets I give out. We're at the bottom of the first slide now, in D. D. Just in case you want to follow. There are many passages in the Torah that talk about Shavuot. And I'm now going to summarize for you two passages in the book of Exodus and one passage in the book of Numbers. and also a passage in the book of Deuteronomy. I'm going to summarize all the passages except for one in the book of Leviticus that we'll deal with extensively after the summary. So what the Torah says about Shavuot, leaving out the book of Leviticus, is the following. That we have here a celebration. Excuse me a second. This is really terrible, but that's my wife in Israel. Oh. Yeah. Ayala? 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 Ayala?
Maybe there's no connection.
Okay, let's see what happens. I apologize again. So, Shavuot is the celebration of the beginning of the wheat harvest. It's the first fruits of the wheat harvest. The Torah does not give it a calendar date. It doesn't say when it is. All of the other holidays have a calendar date. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Passover. We know what day on the calendar and what month. Shavuot, it doesn't say. Secondly, all the other pilgrimage festivals, Sukkot and Passover, have a historical element to them. It's celebrating something that happened in the history of the Jewish people. Passover celebrates the Exodus. Sukkot remembers and commemorates the 40 years that we lived in Sukkot, in booths in the desert when we left Egypt. But Shavuot has no historical element to it. The Torah only says it's the celebration of the grain harvest, of the wheat harvest. So there's no historical element to it, and there's no calendar date. Okay? After we know that, we come to the book of Leviticus and see what Leviticus says about our holiday of Shavuot. So we're going to read in Leviticus now, in the book of Vayikra, chapter 23. Chapter 23. And chapter 23 gives a whole list of all of the holidays. And the list begins, of course, with the holiday of Passover and Matzah. As all the lists of holidays begin there, that's the beginning of the Jewish year. And that's verses 5 and 6 and 7 and 8, talking about Passover. And then we're going to read now from verse 9, chapter 23 of Leviticus. Chapter 23, verse 9. It's page 192 in the English only of the JPS. We're good? We have to read carefully now. The Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Speak to the Israelite people and say to them, when you enter the land that I am giving to you, and you reap its harvest, you shall bring the first sheaf of your harvest to the priest." Everyone reading with me, word for word?
Yes.
"He shall elevate the sheaf before the Lord for acceptance in your behalf." What that means is that you have this harvest, you thank God for it by bringing the first fruits of the harvest to God in the temple, and you wave it before the Lord, or the priest waves it, the Kohen, to show appreciation to God. The priest shall elevate it, the priest waves it in front of God, on the day after the Sabbath. And I have no idea what that means, the day after the Sabbath. All I know is we harvested, we bring the first of the harvest to the temple, we show God thank you, and somehow that's related to the day after the Sabbath, whatever that means. On the day that you elevate the sheaf, you shall offer as a burnt offering to the Lord a lamb of first year without blemish, etc. There's many sacrifices brought on that day. And then we're going to skip down to verse 15. Verse 15. "And from the day on which you bring the sheaf of elevation offering," we just read about, which is the day after the Sabbath, it says, "you shall count off 7 weeks. They shall be complete. You must count until the day after the 7th week, 50 days. Then you shall bring an offering of new grain to the Lord. You shall bring from your settlements 2 loaves of bread." In other words, you bake the new grain into 2 loaves of bread. "As an elevation offering, you shall make each of 2/10 of a measure of choice flour baked after leavening as first fruits to the Lord." Then I'm skipping verses 18 and 19, and I'm skipping 20 also, verse 21. verse 21. On that same day you shall hold a celebration. It shall be a sacred occasion for you. You shall not work at your occupations. This holiday that I just read in verse 21, that's called Chag HaShavuot. Chag HaShavuot is the holiday of weeks. Why is it called the holiday of weeks? Because it comes after 7 weeks of counting. Let me explain everything I just read. Okay? And if anyone has any questions, or if I'm not clear, stop me. There are two grain harvests in the Middle East. Barley and wheat. Barley is in the beginning of the spring, the end of the winter. Wheat is about 7 weeks later, and it's in the end of the spring, the beginning of the summer. Barley is for the animals. Wheat is for human beings. That's the way it was in ancient times. People didn't eat barley. So, we read in verse 9, you come into the land and you harvest. That means the barley harvest, the first harvest of the new year. The first harvest of the agricultural year. You harvest the barley, and it said you bring it to the temple to thank God. You wave it before God on a day called the Mar after the Sabbath. And then it said, you count 7 weeks, 49 days, and the day after this 49th, the 50th day, you bring a new grain offering to the Lord. That's the wheat. Because during these 7 weeks, the wheat has been growing and maturing and ripening in the field. At the end of 7 weeks, you harvest the wheat and you bring the first wheat baked as loaves of bread to the temple. Again, to say thank you to God, this time not for the barley harvest, but for the wheat harvest. And the day that you bring this bread to the temple at the end of 49 days, that's the holiday of Shavuot, the holiday of weeks. Everyone with me? So now, I'm going to put on the table three questions. Two that I mentioned earlier, one that's new. The first question is the following. Indeed, we see the holiday of Shavuot has no calendar day. Why? The first question is why? Every other Jewish holiday has a calendar date. This one doesn't. It's just 7 weeks after the barley harvest. When's the barley harvest? Whenever the conditions in the field are ripe for the barley harvest. So that's the first question. Why is Shavuot different than all the other holidays in that it doesn't have a calendar date? Second question. All the other holidays, all the other pilgrimage festivals, have a historical celebration. They celebrate something that happened to the Jewish people. Shavuot doesn't have it. Why? Shavuot seems to be only the celebration of the harvest. Now, the harvest is a very important thing. Without the wheat, we can't live. It's a staff of life. But why is it the only Jewish holiday without a historical celebration? That's the second question. The third question, what is this morrow after the Sabbath? Remember, it told us when you bring the barley harvest and you wave it to God, but wave it on the day after the Sabbath. What does that mean? That's the third question. Everyone still here? Mm-hmm. Say yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, very good.
Yes.
You're still here. So what I'm going to show now is that the rabbis over 2,000 years ago answered those three questions with one answer. And one answer gives a beautiful solution to all three of the issues. Here we go. If we go to the book of Exodus, chapter 19, we'll find the solution. Exodus chapter 19. Exodus 19 is the introduction to the Ten Commandments. Everyone have the place?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
On the third new moon after the Israelites had gone forth from the land of Egypt. So the third new moon means the third month, the beginning of the month. So they left Egypt, remember, on the 15th of the month, the first month. So there were 15 days left in the first month. And then the second month, has 28 or 30 days. And now it's the first day of the third month. On the third new moon, if the Israelites had gone forth from the land of Egypt, on the very day they entered the wilderness of Sinai, if in journeying from Rephidim, they entered the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, in this camp there in front of the mountain, Mount Sinai, they're about to get the Torah. And Moses went up to God. The Lord called him from the mountain, saying, "Thus shall you say to the house of Jacob, and declare to the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptian, I have borne you in the eagle's wings, brought you to me," etc., etc., etc. Go to verse 7. Moses came and summoned the elders of the people and put before them all the Lord commanded him. All the people answered as one, saying, "All the people have spoken to me will do. All the Lord has spoken to me will do." Moses brought back the people's words to the Lord. So Moses went up to the mountain. It's a high mountain. And he had bad knees. In other words, it took him a while to get up the mountain. Then he came back down the mountain, brought God's words to the people, collected the elders. The elders collected the whole people, told the words of God to the people. The people made a decision to tell God, "We agree." Moses went back up the mountain. He had bad knees, remember? It took a long time. Went up to the mountain and then came down again. The point is that a number of days must pass. At least a number of days must pass. And then, verse 10. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and warn them to stay pure today and tomorrow. Let them wash their clothes. Let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down in the sight of all the people on Mount Sinai." And that's going to be the Ten Commandments. If you look at chapter 20, that's the whole fire and lightning and thunder and shaking, and God reveals himself to the Jewish people with the Ten Commandments. But when did it happen? So if they got to the mountain on the first day of the month, Moses went up and down, up and down. It took at least 3 or 4 days. And then God said, on the third day, I'm going to come down. So that means it happened on the fifth or the sixth or the seventh day of the month. So now we're going to do some computations. They left Egypt on the 15th of the first month. And if each Hebrew month has 20 to 30 days, so we'll see how many days are left in the month. 13 or 14. 13 or 14 days they traveled during the first month after leaving. And then the second month is 28 or 29 days. 28 or 29 days. And then in the third month, they spent 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 days at Mount Sinai, probably 5, 6, or 7, before the Torah was actually given, before the Ten Commandments. So that means 5 to 7 days. Let's add it up. How many days passed since they left Egypt? So at the minimum, it's 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. It's 46. At the maximum, it's 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16,
17,
18, 19. 50. Is it 50? 50, okay, 50. So 46 until 50 days have passed.
Your phone's ringing.
Hello. Ayla, ani be'emtza shiur, afshat kasher od rev sha'a? Ken. So, 46 or 50 days have passed since they left Egypt. So we don't know exactly when the Torah was given. But it was approximately within this framework. Now let's go back to what we learned in the book of Leviticus. When is the holiday of Shavuot? 50 days after you begin counting. When do you begin counting? We're not sure. There's no calendar date. You begin counting when you bring the barley harvest. When is that? A different time every year. But remember, it's said that you begin counting when you bring the first of the barley to the temple, and you should do that on the morrow after the Sabbath. If we could only interpret the morrow after the Sabbath to mean Passover, then 50 days from Passover will be the holiday of Shavuot, which just happens to be the day the Torah might have been given. And therefore the rabbis found a way to interpret morrow after the Sabbath to mean Passover, so that in doing so, we answered all our three questions. We figured out what morrow after the Sabbath means, and we gave Shavuot a particular day on the calendar, Because if it's 50 days from Passover, it always will be the same calendar of the year, and it will become, Shavuot will become a holiday on the same day the Torah was given. It'll become the holiday celebrating giving of the Torah. Now, how, you hear what I'm saying? How did, you've heard this too many times.
I'm starting to know it.
So, and all it's going to connect to the manna in another 5 minutes. In the Torah, in the book of Leviticus, we actually can look at this right now. In the book of Leviticus, in chapter 23, look at Leviticus 23:32. 23:32. It's discussing Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Chapter 23, verse 32. And it says, "It shall be a Sabbath of complete rest for you. And you shall practice self-denial on the ninth day of the month at evening. From evening to evening you shall observe this your Sabbath." What do you see from here? That the holiday of Yom Kippur is called Sabbath. So the word Sabbath in the Torah usually means the seventh day of the week. But it sometimes means a day with Sabbath-like practices. Means a holiday when you don't work like on the Sabbath. Therefore, when the Torah said that you bring the barley harvest on the morrow after the Sabbath, and then you count 50 days, the rabbis have a basis to say that morrow after the Sabbath means morrow after a holiday. And what holiday could it be? Well, if you go back to the book of Leviticus, those verses are spoken morrow after the Sabbath, right after the discussion of Passover. The rabbi said, morrow after the Sabbath? When could that be? Sabbath could be a holiday. What holiday? The context is Passover, so it means the day after Passover. And therefore, the rabbis answered three questions at once. What is morrow after the Sabbath? It means the day after Passover. That's when you begin counting. And if so, the counting ends up 50 days later, the holiday of Shavuot, which just happens to be the Torah might have been given that day. So now we have a calendar day for Shavuot, 50 days after Passover, 51 actually, the morrow after Passover, which just so happens to be the day the Torah might have been given. So Shavuot now became the holiday of the commemoration of the giving of the Torah, even though the Torah never said that explicitly. The rabbis found it. The rabbis uncovered it. What that means is, if you're still with me, and if you can stop me if you want, what that means is the written Torah, the five books of Moses, doesn't give us any holiday to celebrate Torah. There's a holiday to celebrate the Exodus, holiday to celebrate the 40 years in the desert. There's no holiday to celebrate Torah in the written Torah. The rabbis, the oral law, Jewish interpretation, Jewish tradition, found a way to interpret the written Torah so that a holiday, Shavuot, an agricultural holiday, becomes the holiday of the giving of the Torah. Now, what does that mean theologically? It means something brilliant that's going to tie into the manna. What it means is the following. It means that there's no celebration of the giving of the Torah unless the Jewish people find that celebration. There's no celebration of Torah unless the Jewish people partner with the Torah to find the celebration, to uncover it, to create it, to engender it. And what the deeper meaning of that is that there's really no Torah without the Jewish people's partnership in Torah. The Torah, the five books of Moses, is a dead letter. It's meaningless unless we invest in it all our efforts for interpretation and find meaning in it. That's exactly the point now of the holiday of Shavuot. The holiday of Shavuot, therefore, is not merely the holiday of the giving of the Torah. It's the holiday of the creating of the meaning of the Torah, of discovering in Torah, a holiday of Torah, It's of discovering greater meaning of Torah. Shavuot is about the partnership between the Jewish people and the text to create the meaning that sustains us in every generation. That's very powerful. There's no giving the Torah without the Jewish people being involved in partnering with the Torah and finding what it means. And even though the time is a little bit late, I just want to tie everything in by reading this beautiful parable in the rabbis that's in the sheets I gave out to you. It's going to take 5 minutes, even six, but it will put everything together. Once I was on a journey, and I came upon a man who went at me after the way of heretics. He was a heretic. The rabbi is talking, and he calls this other guy a heretical type of guy. Now, he accepted the written but not the oral law. So this guy accepted the written Torah, the five books of Moses, but the oral law, the interpretation, he didn't like. He said, that's not for me. Take it or leave it, and I'm leaving it. He said to me, the written law was given us from Mount Sinai. The oral law was not given us from Mount Sinai. Look, God gave the written Torah. I have to accept it. The oral law, that's a human interpretation, a human creation. It's not given at Mount Sinai, so therefore, I don't need it. I said to him, but were not both the written and the oral law spoken by the omnipresent? So the rabbi says, Guy, you're crazy. God spoke not just the written, but even the oral law, the human interpretation. God gave us that. What does that mean? So the rabbi goes on to explain what he means, that God gave us even the oral law, the interpretation. Then what is the difference between the written oral law? I'll explain to you, says the rabbi, by a parable. To what can this be compared? To a king of flesh and blood, who had two servants, and loved them both with a perfect love. He had two ministers, the minister of the interior and the minister of war, let's say. And he gave them each a measure of wheat and a bundle of flax. The wise servant, what did he do? He took the flax and spun a cloth. Then he took the wheat and made flour. The flour he cleansed and ground and kneaded and baked and set on top of the table. Then he spread the cloth over it and left it so the king, until the king should come. But the foolish servant did nothing at all. He left the wheat and the flax as he got it. After some days, the king returned from a journey and came into his house and said to them, my sons, bring me what I gave you. One servant showed the wheaten bread on the table with the cloth spread over it, and the other servant showed the wheat still in a box with a bundle of flax upon it. Alas for his shame, alas for his disgrace, which means, according to the parable, that the servant who left the wheat and the flax as he had been given it is shameful. He didn't do the proper thing. Now, I'm going to stop for a minute with the parable and explain. If I was one of those servants, and the king gave me a bundle of flax and a bundle of wheat, I might very well say to myself, whoa, that's royal. The king gave me his stuff. I'm going to preserve it. I'm going to put it in a safe under lock and key. I'm not going to tamper it because it's the king's. But according to this parable, that's the wrong way to do it. It's a way of reverence for the king and respect for the king, but the king doesn't merely want reverence and respect. The king just doesn't want yes men. The king doesn't want people who take what he says and accept it as it is. The king wants creative partnership. The king gave these bundles, flax and wheat, to his servants to test them and challenge them. This servant that kept it under lock and key and didn't change it, didn't develop it, left it as is, that servant is very reverent of the king, but he failed the test. The servant that understood what he's supposed to do is take the raw materials and develop them into a tablecloth, into bread, however he sees fit, he passed the test because he showed himself to be not only a yes man of the king, he showed himself to be a creative partner with the king. And the king comes back and sees the tablecloth with the bread and he says, that's what you can do with what I gave you with my raw materials. That's great. You have a degree of courage and of independence that the king values, that the king wants. And then it says, at the end of the story, now when the Holy One, blessed be He, gave the Torah to Israel, He gave it only in the form of wheat. For us to extract flour from it and flax to extract the garment. The Torah is like raw materials. And although a very understandable reaction to getting the Torah would be to put it under lock and key. That's the Torah. I'm not tampering with it. I'm just taking it as it is. That's a person of great reverence for God. But that's not the right way. You don't just need reverence. You need courage, audacity, independence, and creativity to take the raw materials and do something with them. Now, the rabbi at the beginning of this story said that both the oral Torah and the written are from God. The written being this, the oral being the interpretation. In what sense does the parable teach us that both the written and the oral are from God? The oral is the interpretation. How could they become from that from God? That's what we do with it. That's the making of the bread and the tablecloth. How could that be from God? In the following sense. Now the whole point of the parable is that when the king gives you the raw materials, what you will make of it is you, your input, but it's already latent in potential in the raw materials. The wheat is wheat, but the wheat has the possibility of bread in it. The flax is flax, has the possibility of a tablecloth in it. It has many possibilities, but it has all those possibilities latent in it. So what it means is that God gave us this Torah, and this Torah contains within it what Myra's going to say.
No, but it does.
It contains what all the rabbis and all the Jewish people will find in it. It's already there in potentiality. The oral Torah is within the written Torah, but we have to extract it. We have to not keep our distance. We have to come at it as something ours. That's our wheat. That's our flax. God wants us to make bread. How the bread is going to come out? Howard's bread comes out different than your bread comes out. Now, there are certain rules of how to do it, but within those rules, we have the responsibility of that partnership and that interaction. And that relates to the manna. Why? Because in the period of the desert, God gave us everything and said, you don't do anything, you just eat. In the period of the land of Israel, God gave us the raw materials and said, you interact with the earth and bring forth what you can bring forth. So, if we relate that to the parable, the period of the man in the desert, that's like the foolish servant. You just take it as it is, God gives it to you, you accept it, you're passive. That's not the way it's supposed to be. The ultimate goal is to go into the land of Israel. In the land of Israel, God provides the raw materials, but you have to have the courage and the audacity and the creativity and the initiative to do something with it. And whatever you do with it, that's an expression of your partnership with God. And it's the same thing with the Torah. Just like we partner with God by building up this physical world and making something of it, we partner with God by building up the Torah and making something greater of it. And the last things I'll say is whatever we make of it, that's already part of the original intention. That's part of the plan. It's latent there. It's in there in potential. And the challenge is to use our God-given gifts to make something better of it. And that's the holiday of Shavuot. That's the celebration of the partnership between the Jewish people and the written Torah to make something even bigger and greater.
Wonderful.
That's the story.
Wonderful. Rob, when is this going to be on your recorded?
Within 2 weeks or even 1 week, I usually put it up.